Are there questions about last week? Okay, if not, let me just briefly say what we did last week and where we will continue. Last week, we started by studying one-dimensional topological quantum field theories, and we managed to identify them with a category we called duals in C, where C is any symmetric monoidal category. But as I said, the most important example for us will be the category of vector spaces. So we defined this category duals in C, and we started to study some of its properties, and that's what we will continue doing today. But let me just recall what the definition is. An object in here consists of two objects in C. You should think of them as this being the object your field theory assigns to a positively oriented point, and this the object assigns to a negatively oriented point. And then there are two morphisms called evaluation and co-evaluation. One goes from x tensor x dual to 1, which is the value of the field theory on borderisms, which look like this. And then the other map goes from 1 to x dual tensor x, which is the value of the field theory on borderisms looking like this. Okay. And then they have to satisfy two conditions. And the conditions are here. So they mean if I look at this thing, which looks a bit like a snake, in particular, if we draw the evaluation like this, then this looks a bit like a snake and you can pull it straight. And these things are usually called snake relations. So they mean if I start with x, I do the co-evaluation to create x dual tensor x, and then the evaluation that this composition is the identity, and the same for the dual one. Okay. So far, so good. So these are the objects. So if you give me a list of x dual evaluation and co-evaluation, there's a unique one-dimensional topological quantum field theory corresponding to it. And last time we also have seen how to compute certain informations about it. And then the morphisms, so they are what corresponds to natural transformations or symmetries of the field theory. They are given. So if I have two such objects denoted by x and x prime, a morphism is a pair of maps, one which we call f plus from x to x prime, and the other one going between the duals, which satisfies this type of compatibility relations with the evaluation and co-evaluation. Okay. And last time we already have seen if I fix x, then x dual is uniquely determined up to an isomorphism. So there's only one choice for the dual up to isomorphism. And we will just continue studying this category for a bit and then see that it's actually equivalent to a slightly simpler category. And I should also say, right, this is something we saw last time as well. Anything we learn about one-dimensional topological quantum field theories gives us also a statement for the state space of any field theory via a construction which is called dimensional reduction. And we will see some applications of this during today's lecture. Okay. So, yeah. The next statement is just more properties of this object. I think I stopped numbering things, so just do that. And it says that this category is actually is a groupoid. So this means all morphisms in the category are invertible. So if I give you two such maps, I claim that f plus and f minus both have an inverse. And the proof is just via direct construction. So I need to tell you what is the inverse of f plus, which is a map from it's a map from x prime to x with the convention that's supposed to go the other direction. What it does is I use the evaluation, then f minus, and then the co-evaluation. Okay. So we start with x prime. We do evaluation prime. So here we have x prime dual. Here I can have, here we have x. Now f minus is a map x dual. F minus is a map from x dual to x prime dual. So I can put it here, and I can put the co-evaluation here. This defines the inverse, or a proposal for an inverse of f plus. And then we also define f minus inverse in the same way. This is a map from x prime dual to x dual, which we define by this picture. So it's a morphism corresponding to this picture. So it's supposed to go from x prime dual. So here we do evaluation prime. And here there's an x prime. Here's an x. F is a map from x to x prime. Here we do the co-evaluation, and we are at x. Okay. And now what we have to show is that these two things, that they are actually inverses to f plus and f minus. So we will just check one of the relations, and then all the other ones follow the same. So I just take this thing and I compose it with f minus. I want to see it's the identity. So the composition is, is this, but I just put an f minus here, so there's an f minus there. And now I use the relation here that if I have an f minus and an f plus above a co-evaluation, I can just pull it through to get a co-evaluation prime. So this is the same as co-evaluation prime, evaluation prime. And then this is exactly the relation we have over here, that this is, because it's a duality, this is the identity. So we see this is the identity. So we have seen that if I compose this with f minus, I get the identity. If I compose it in the other direction, I have an f minus here. Then I can take these two things and pull them through the evaluation prime to get an evaluation. And then I can again apply a Snell's relation to see the identity. So let me just say all as a compositions work the same. So we have learned that any map in here which satisfies these conditions automatically needs to be an isomorphism. And I mean, as I said, these things now, what we will do is also see what type of implications this has for TQFTs in general. And this is a corollary of the statement. It's just, so if we have some natural transformation between two topological field theories, so be a symmetric monoidal natural transformation, in between now n-dimensional TQFTs, then eta is automatically invertible, is a natural isomorphism. And this is really just applying the statement we had there to one-dimensional, two-dimensional reductions. So the proof is, so we start with eta, and then we fix some sigma in our Bordism category. And I can look at the dimensional reduction on sigma of eta, which is a natural transformation between the dimensional reductions of the field series. So this just means that if I look at eta, right, a natural transformation has a value at any object. So I can look at the pair of the natural transformation at sigma, and at sigma with reversed orientation, then this is a morphism in this category of objects with duals in vector spaces. And then by the previous result, this implies that both of them are inverses, but in particular, have inverse. So in particular, eta at sigma is an iso. And then since now eta is an isomorphism at every object, this implies that eta is an natural isomorphism. And this thing can, the statement can be extremely useful, because if you want to relate two field theories, or you want to show that two field theories are the same, you only need to give any natural transformation between them, and then you can automatically conclude that it's an isomorphism. So you never need to check that something is an isomorphism. It depends a bit on what exactly the setting is, but these things are exactly, if you do fully extended series, they are exactly what the symmetry defects are, more or less, yeah. But they are only the invertible defects, I mean, because they are isomorphisms.
So just to go over again, so whenever you have a natural transformation, then it means that, well, it will be a natural isomorphism.
Yes, exactly. That's the statement.
And what was that? Sorry, the proof in words reads.
The proof says you take your natural isomorph, a natural transformation,
yes.
And then you fix some object, and you look at its dimensional reduction, which gives you a morphism of 1D field series.
Okay.
And then this statement here says any morphism of 1D field series is invertible.
Okay.
So you know the morphism upstairs of n-dimensional field series is pointwise invertible, and then being pointwise invertible means that it's a natural isomorphism. Because being a natural isomorphism is something you can check one object at a time.
Oh. It's pointwise invertible, meaning pointwise...
At every object.
At every object.
Yeah.
But so the reduction to the lower object is isomorphic, so as an isomorphism... Well, I also wasn't left to think about it. Why? Never mind, yeah.
I mean, so what the argument is, so if I have a morphism of one dimensional field series, it's a morphism in this dual of C.
Yeah.
And all morphisms in there are isomorphisms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you define dual of an, of like the higher dimensional version, not taking just a symmetric monoidal category, but the one that corresponds to a higher dimensional field theory?
I'm not sure what exactly the question is. I don't know if that's the answer you want, but if you look at extended field theories, they also assign values in higher categories to a point. So if you look at an n-dimensional fully extended theory, it's something, assigns something to the point which is an object in this n category. And then there's a notion of being n-dualizable, so that this statement still holds. N-dualizable objects are the same as n-dimensional framed topological field theories, which is called the cobordism hypothesis. So this gives you a strong algebraic way of classifying topological field theories of arbitrary dimension. I'm not sure if that's the question, but this is...
Yes, but the question is, does that proposition also hold for those ones?
Yes,
okay.
They are always good for it. I mean, essentially, being an isomorphism is something you can check on truncations. And if you take this higher thing and you truncate it, you can use the same argument. Okay, and now the next thing is we introduce this complicating looking thing, and we now want to identify it with something simpler. That's what we build up to next. I mean, complicating might be an overstatement. Anyway, so we so let okay yeah so we again have some symmetric monoidal category. And then we define a new category, which we call C, fully dualizable, or just dualizable here. And it's the category it's a subcategory of C, which has all the objects which admit a dual. So of C on all objects in C admitting call this thing a right dual. But we don't fix a right dual, so we just take all objects in C which have the property that there's at least one dual, which we then know is unique, emitting a right dual and isomorphisms. I mean, so this fully dualizable or maybe finite dimensional means that we restrict to objects having a dual, and then this cross means we restrict to things which only two maps which are isomorphisms. Okay. And then the statement is the following proposition, which is so there's a functor which goes from this category of duals in C to this category we just introduced. And it sends a pair x, x dual evaluation, co evaluation just to x, and a map f plus f minus will be just mapped to the map f plus from x to x prime. And we know this is an isomorphism by the previous result, so we know it lands in here. This has a dual because it already comes from something with a dual. And the statement is that, I mean, this is clearly a functor, and the statement is that this is actually an equivalence. Is an equivalence categories. So in the end, what this proposition will tell us is one-dimensional field theories are actually classified by this groupoid, which is just a subset of all the objects we have in our category and those which have the property of having duals.
Yes, the definition says that there is a dual and it's isomorph and there is an isomorphism.
No, the definition is so it's
and,
the objects are those objects which have dual.
Yes.
And morphisms are only isomorphisms. And isomorphism between those as morphisms. Right. And I mean, we already know that any morphism in here will be an isomorphism. So if I want this to be an equivalence, I at least need to restrict to the isomorphism. And this is somehow, the best thing. Okay.
And Lucas. In a dual of C, we only take objects that have duals in C, or do we artificially add duals?
No, I mean, but dual C, an object in this thing is really all these informations. So in particular, it's an object together with a choice of a dual, a choice of an evaluation map, and a choice of a co-evaluation map.
But if X didn't have a dual in the original category C,
then there's no object in dual C which corresponds to X. Yeah. You are not adding anything. You are just building a new category. And somehow the statement is, you see, on this side, it looks like there's more data, right? It looks like there's an X dual, there are all these choices. And the statement is just that these choices are essentially are unique in the sense that there's an equivalent of carriers. So if I know X and I have something like this, it's more or less unique. I mean, we already have seen last time that X dual is unique up to a unique isomorphism. Somehow the whole thing is unique. Okay. Okay, and we will show that based on the following elementary fact, which is going to be an exercise. We have like an easy way of checking when a functor is an equivalent. I mean, you probably know a map between sets is an equivalent if it's injective and surjective, or it's a bijection. And the same turns out to be true for functors by formulating these things correctly. And so if we have a functor, any functor G, which goes from a category C to another category D, then this is an equivalence. If and only if first G is what's called essentially surjective. Meaning for all D and D, they exist C and C such that G of C is isomorphic to D. So this just means if I have some object in D, I can find a pre-image up to an isomorphism. So it might not need to be surjective directly, but it's surjective up to some isomorphisms in D. And that's what the word essentially means here. So that's the first property. And then there's a version of injectivity, which is G is what's called fully faithful. So, and this means that the maps, if I have G, then this defines part of the functor G is a map from HOM, from C to C prime in C. I get a map to HOM in D, G of C, G of C prime. And this needs to be a bijection. Then it's fully faithful. It's a bijection or isomorphism. So as soon as I have a functor like this, you can use these two properties to build an inverse. And as I said, this is an exercise, and it's actually, if you have not had that much exposure to categories before, I think it's a nice one just to learn how to work with them. But it's also really standard, so you can find it in any book on categories if you want. But we will use this fact just to, well, we want to show that a certain thing is an equivalence, and to show this, we just show that it's essentially surjective and fully faithful. Proof. So this is now the proof of this proposition. I think I should give this a name. Let's call it F.
And this would be in substitution of saying there exists two functors that compose some sort of identity functor?
Yes. I mean, right, remember, an equivalence means that there is a functor G inverse.
Yeah.
So that G times G inverse is naturally isomorphic to the identity, and the other composition is also naturally isomorphic to the identity. And this is a different way of checking the same thing. And I mean, so seeing that if you have an equivalence, these two things hold, is not that hard. And the other direction is just a concrete construction of an inverse. You can use these two properties to do. Okay.
And also, sorry, and the point from before, because I struggled to really grasp it. So what's this new object that we defined that we say is going to be equivalent to the dual thing?
I mean, this is just, right, we started with this category C.
Yeah.
And then just we restrict to some subcategory.
Yeah.
Which has S objects or the objects which have a dual.
Oh.
We just have the property that there is at least one dual.
there is at least one dual. But
yeah.
Dual meaning...
in this sense, that there is an x-dual evaluation and co-evaluation. That is in the sense up there.
So in some sense, how is it different from this case? Since here we say...
I mean, here, right? Here I pick x-dual evaluation and co-evaluation.
Yeah.
Here I just require the property of x to have a dual. Yeah. Right, and here I say, oh, I take maps which are compatible with all the structure. Here I just take all isomorphisms. So somehow, right, the statement or the takeaway of this proposition is really all this choice, like choosing these things and this, is redundant.
Okay, so instead, just by choosing a dual is enough? No.
I mean, just having an object where you know it has a dual is enough. You don't even need to choose the dual. Somehow the dual will be, there's a unique way of choosing a dual.
So once you know it has a dual, then it means, yes, there's a unique way because of what you proved the other week, last week.
Yeah.
And then co-evaluation and evaluation fall, and the morphisms fall off for free.
Yes. And all isomorphisms will live to isomorphisms which are compatible with these things. If you want to know what the field theory does, right? If I start with an X and I want to figure out what the field theory does, I need to pick such a pre-image. So I need to pick X dual evaluation and co-evaluation to be able to evaluate the theory.
So dual of C is a theory, since we've at least in the 1D.
Yeah, an object in here is a 1D TQFT.
Perfect. An object there is a 1D TQFT, okay. And what were you saying about how things relate to theory, sorry?
The only thing I was saying, if you start with X,
yeah,
but you know you can build a 1D TQFT out of that.
Okay.
Or 1D theory.
An X belonging to this guy, because we're guaranteed a dual exists, therefore I can build a 1D TQFT.
Yeah, therefore you know you know there's an equivalent, so you know there's an inverse.
Yeah.
So you can pick something here, which will be the inverse, and then you can build a 1D TQFT out of it. But to evaluate the TQFT on some manifolds, you actually need to know what is the evaluation, what's the co-evaluation. I mean, yeah. Here, this is still slightly easy. If you go to extended field theories, knowing that there are these things and figuring out what they are is a big difference. So if you have a three-dualizable object, like figuring out what all these things are and even what you need to specify, it's a lot of work. The proof. I mean, F is essentially surjective. And this is true by construction. What do I mean with that? I just mean, we already is, like essentially we said, oh, we only take those objects in C which emit a dual. Meaning they admit a pre-image, so it's even exactly surjective. So it's like for every object here, I can find a pre-image. And this is just really restricted to those which have the property. So there's nothing to do here. But then we need to show that F is fully faithful. And we will do this in two steps. We want to show that this is an isomorphism. So we show it's surjective and injective. So we have F, which goes from Hom from x dual evaluation x, co evaluation x, take the Hom to y dual evaluation y, co evaluation y, and I have a map, there's a bracket missing here, to just Hom to the isomorphism from x to y. So this is the Hormann C cross. And we want to show that this map is both surjective and injective. So what do we do first? Okay, we start with injectivity. So this, what does it mean for a map to be injective? Means if I have two elements in here, which will be mapped to the same element down here, then they might already need to be equal. So what happens is I have F plus, F minus is one morphism, and then I have another morphism which needs to be mapped to the same thing as a map from X to Y. So I need to know that F plus is F plus, but F minus, they might be different. And what we want to show is that these things are equal as morphisms in the category. So we want to show that F minus is equal to F minus. So let's start with F minus. This is a map from X dual to Y dual. Then I put in a co-evaluation for Y. So I put in, this is just, oh, I should leave the F here. So this is F minus, this is evaluation for Y, co-evaluation for Y. So I just, this is equal to the identity, so I can just plug it in there. Then I know co-evaluation for Y is actually the same as co-evaluation for X. And then I put F. So I put F prime minus F plus. And this is a condition that this pair is a morphism of things with dual. This is still evaluation Y, and I have F minus. So this is just exactly the second condition on the blackboard up there. Okay. But now I can use the other condition to see that this is evaluation X. So I see this is equal to F minus evaluation for X. This is the co-evaluation for X. So I can replace, this is now again an identity. So this is just, this should be a prime. This is now F minus prime. So we have seen that F minus is equal to F minus prime, and hence they are equal. So we have seen it's injective. And now we need to see it's surjective, meaning if I have a map down here, so I have a map from X to Y, I need to lift this to a pair of maps F. So I need to make this F plus, and then I need to construct for you an F minus. So surjectivity, and there we just define a corresponding F minus. So we fix some F, which goes from X to Y, and then we set and set F minus to be so right. I know this is an isomorphism, so I can invert it, and then I can draw this. So there's co-evaluation for Y, evaluation for X. This is a map from X dual to Y dual, and I claim this is F, and F minus together give me a morphism between the objects. This is, I mean, you should, yeah. And now, let's just say it's easy. Well, maybe you should just check F plus, or F comma F minus is a morphism in dual. Questions.
What does it mean physically to not admit a dual?
We will figure out in two statements what this is for. Vector spaces, and having a dual means being finite dimensional. So somehow this implies, as one statement, if you have a TQFT satisfying the axioms we have here, all its state spaces will be finite dimensional. So that's a strong finiteness condition.
And in the side of the manifolds?
And on the side of the manifold, it means essentially if I have some space, and then I can, if I can evaluate my field theory on these things, then this is always the same as this type of map. And if I look at a, like it somehow means if I have a bordism which looks like a snake, I can pull it straight. And this is what it means to have duals. And this gives a strong constraint.
But this means that all bordisms have duals, right?
It also means that every object in the bordism category has a dual, yes. And it's exactly this. What?
Yeah.
Right, I mean, okay. More questions?
Yeah, so I wanted to just digest what this was saying. So the space of homomorphisms from quadruplet of X's and then this other one.
Yeah.
So those are tuples F plus S F minus.
Yes.
And we have to show that.
And there's the map which just forgets the F minus.
That's exactly.
And somehow we have to show that this is an isomorphism.
We have to show that that is an isomorphism. That means that, well, yeah, for every for the F plus.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Or it's a bijection. So we show it's surjective and injective. These things are sets.
Okay, so injective and surjective. Okay, meaning, and now would you just prove injectivity?
And surjectivity by just. For every F downstairs, I just told you how you can lift it to a map upstairs.
An F minus, perfect.
Okay.
And this one is if injectivity is, two different things cannot map to the same thing.
Yeah.
Where if two things are equal downstairs, if F plus, I would have said if F plus prime is equal to F plus, then the tuples are the same.
Yes, this is right. So somehow we start with two tuples which have the same F plus and different F minuses, and we conclude F minus is actually equal to F minus prime.
Perfect, yeah, got it.
That's the computation we did.
Got it.
Yeah. Yep.
So in the category of, so in finite dimensional vector space and for manifolds in the bordism category, they're both objects that are sort of self-dual?
They are objects that are self-dual, yes.
Do you have any examples of objects whose dual is not just itself?
I mean, in the one-dimensional bordism category, the point, but you have a positive point, and its dual is the negative point, and they are not isomorphic. So this is not self-dual. And even in the category of vector spaces, the dual vector space will be isomorphic to the original one, but somehow it's not canonically isomorphic, right? You need to pick a basis or something like that. I think there are better examples, but there are also examples. I mean, since it's symmetric monoidal, I have not distinguished between left and right dual. But there are also examples if you don't have a braiding where the left and right dual are different. Okay, and now all the hard work allows us to state the main theorem of the section, which is the category of 1D TQFTs with values in C is equivalent to, I mean, we have already seen it's equivalent to C duals in C, but it's now also equivalent to the screw point introduced here. So this gives a complete description of one-dimensional field series. And so it means somehow specifying a map out of a one-dimensional bordism category is the same as specifying one dualizable object in the target. So you should think of the bordism category as a free symmetric monoidal category on a dualizable object. Because it's like maps out of there are just the same as specifying something dualizable. Okay. And now the promise statement about vector spaces. just the following proposition. A vector space is dualizable if and only if it is finite dimensional. Okay. So we need to show two directions. The first one is if we have a vector space which is finite dimensional, it's dualizable. So we will start with that. So we show this direction, which is let V be a finite dimensional vector space. And then we can just define a dual. So we define V dual to be maps from V to, let's say, C. Well, this is a vector space. Again, we take linear maps from V to C. And I need to define an evaluation. So the evaluation is just goes from V tensor Hom from V to C. To C, which is the monoid unit, and it's literally just the evaluation. So if I have a map and a vector, I can evaluate the map on the vector. This is the usual evaluation. But then to be a dual, I also need to give you a co-evaluation. I mean, right, this would work for infinite dimensional vector spaces as well, but the co-evaluation will not. So let me write down the co-evaluation for V, which is a map from C to V dual tensor V. But now note that if I look at V dual tensor V, this is actually isomorphic to the endomorphisms of V. Right, if I have, so there's a map from here to there, which just sends a pair of these things to the map from V to V, which evaluates with this and takes the V.
And this is why we need a finite dimensionality.
Yes.
We can always send from C to Y there.
Yeah, exactly. And here I have a map which sends goes to the identity. And then I can compose with this isomorphism to get the co-evaluation. No. Okay. And we can also differently say what the co-evaluation does. It goes from C to V tensor V dual, and it sends 1, so the object 1 in here, gets mapped to just the product. So I pick some basis of V, and I just sum over E tensor the dual basis. And this is actually an expression which is basis independent, as you can see, because it will represent the identity. Or in physics, you might write, I don't know, this is something like this. And you know that inserting something like this is somehow the same as inserting an identity. So it's what you use when you change basis in quantum mechanics. And now let us check one of the snake relations. So which one are we checking? The one on the left. So we just trace what happens with a vector. So we start with a vector in V, then we apply the co-evaluation. This gets mapped to V tensor EI. Tensor EI star. Wait. Does this go to the right thing? No. Should go here. There's a star here. Okay. There's a star here. And then I do the evaluation. So I get a sum EI star evaluated on V EI. And this is just the expression for V in the basis EI. So this is V again. Okay. So this checks one of the snake identities. The other one is exactly the same, but for the dual. Oh. Okay. And now we want to see that if V has a dual, it's finite dimension. Right? So this is somehow the other direction. So let V dual be a dual to V. And now V is anything. V can a priori be infinite dimensional. But then we know that there's a map we call co-evaluation for V, which goes from C to V tensor V dual, V dual tensor V, which will send one, but it will send it to some element in this tensor product. So it will send it to some finite sum wi tensor vi. Right, any element in the tensor product I can write as a finite sum of elementary tensors. So it will send it to something like this. This is co-evaluation of one. And now we just see what this identity tells us, that this composition is the identity, and it says that the identity, which just maps an object V to itself, is equal to, I do this co-evaluation, so let's say the sum runs from 1 to k. Then I see that, so I do this, and then I do the evaluation pairing. So we see it's sum from I to k, I equal 1 to k. I evaluate V and Wi. So this will be some complex number, and then I do Vi. Okay. So any object V I can write as a finite sum of Vi's. So this already, this tells me that Vi, I equals 1 to k, is a generating set for V, but then it's the vector space is generated by finitely many vectors. I mean, they usually don't form a basis, but it's a generating set and it's finite, so this tells me that V is finite dimensional. Okay. And now we can just use this via dimensional reduction to conclude that all state spaces are finite dimensional. So the state space of any n-dimensional t, or the state spaces, so there are now more for any manifold, there's one, is finite dimensional. And I mean, the proof is just again, we do dimensional reduction on sigma for our theory Z. This is a 1D theory, so it's a functor from board 1 to vect, which will send the positively oriented point to Z on sigma. And this implies that G of sigma is in particular dualizable, so it's finite dimensional. Okay. Then similarly, let's maybe just leave this as an exercise, if I look at the invariant evaluated on sigma times S1, then this will be some complex number of the TQFT. This number is always the dimension of Z on sigma. So I know this is finite dimensional, so it has a dimension, and I can evaluate this dimension by just computing the partition function on this product, which in particular needs to be an integer and positive.
Why does that not return a vector space?
Because this is an n-dimensional manifold. So we get a, right, this is a Bordism from the empty set to itself. So it gives a linear map from C to C, which is a complex number. And this complex number actually turns out to be the dimension of the vector space. This again, so how would you prove this? If you just prove this statement is true for a 1D field series. So the proof is in 1D that I can look what is Z of S1. We have already, it's like this composed with the flip, and then I do this. So what does this map do? It sends 1. I do the co-evaluation, so I send it to the basis EI tensor EI star. Okay, I think the star was here. Now I flip. So the flip just exchanges the order. And then I evaluate, so it maps it to some EI star evaluated on EI. So this is just a 1. So this is the dimension of whatever Z on a positive point. And then the general statement is just do dimensional reduction on sigma and evaluate the field theory on 1. And then you see that this is the dimension. Yeah. So in particular, it's usually easy, if you have a TQFT, it's easy to compute dimensions of state spaces. You can just compute partition functions on these cylinders, on these type of manifolds. Okay. I think this is everything I wanted to say about 1D TQFT. So are there questions about those?
Yeah, sorry. I also, the blackboard that preceded this one is covered, right?
What's
the one that you have known right now, the middle one?
This one,
the
yeah.
The one that preceded this one is covered. Because I'm trying to remember, I was trying to...
You asked me a really common, I don't know.
I think it's the one
behind this, I'm just saying. Because I'm struggling to remember what we're trying to prove here.
About
the co-evaluation.
At this one, yeah. It's covered, so the answer is yes.
Because there, you mentioned something about infinite dimensional vector spaces. There's a failure there. And I suppose it is, V dual tensor V is no longer endomorphic.
You don't have this isomorphism anymore. In particular, the identity, but you have a map here, but the identity will not lie in its image.
Will not lie in dimension.
In the, right, there's a map from V dual tensor V to the endomorphisms of V. You always can write down this map. But the identity is not going to be in its image if it's not finite dimensional.
Maybe I looked into the composition of unity for physicists was a mistake because they usually take the infinite. So.
Yeah, but then you have a Hilbert space and there's, right, it's not a basis, it's a Hilbert basis thing. Yeah, but maybe you're right, maybe that was a mistake. So we are done with 1D.
What happens if you put an interval instead of a circle?
You get the identity. If you mean this, right? So this is always in the Bordism category, this is the identity. So it will be the field theory evaluated on it will just be the identity map from the positively oriented point to itself. I think we've... the next goal is just to spend like 5 or 10 minutes explaining constructions to get new field theories out of old ones, or ways of like operations between T of T. So this is operations. Okay, for TQ of T. So the first one, I think we already have seen that. But if I have two functors, Z1 and Z2, from an n-dimensional Bordism category to vector spaces, then I can form a new functor or a new series, which we call Z1 tensor Z2, which also goes from the Bordism category to vect. And it sends a manifold sigma, or it sends a Bordism M from sigma to sigma prime to the Bordism Z1 of M tensor Z2 of M from Z1 on sigma tensor Z2 on sigma. And this is a map to Z1 on sigma prime tensor Z2 on sigma prime. And the statement is that this is again a topological field theory. So if you have two of them, you can tensor them together. In physics, this is sometimes called stacking. And then there's a trivial theory, which is usually called one, from Bordisms in dimension n to vector spaces, which just sends n equal Bordism just to the identity map from C to C. This map doesn't do anything. It's a trivial map. And then we can give the following definition. Z is invertible. If there exists Z inverse such that Z tensor Z inverse is canonically isomorphic to the theory, this is naturally isomorphic to the theory one, and it's also the same for the other order. So Z minus one tensor Z is isomorphic to one as well. So I call a theory invertible if it has an inverse with respect to the stacking operation. Okay, and also one consequence of this is that the state spaces need to be invertible. So if I tensor the state spaces, I need to get something one-dimensional, so they need to be one-dimensional. Okay. And maybe we will see a bit more about those in later lectures, because nowadays they are what classifies certain types of anomalies. Okay. And then, so we have a tensor product of field theories. And there's also a direct sum operation for field theories, which I'm not going to spell out in detail. Leave that as an exercise, which actually is less trivial than you might think when you first see it. So there's an exercise. So we defined a tensor product, and now the exercise is to define the direct sum of two field theories. And why is this, might this be problematic? Just if I define Z plus Z2 on an object in the Bordism category as this, then this operation is not monoidal. It's not monoidal. Just if I take the disjoint union, I want to get the tensor product. But if I take the tensor product here, I would get some cross terms. So you cannot just define it like this. So you need to find a way around this problem. But there is a notion of a direct sum. And yeah, depending on what we will do at the end, this might also show up again. So this is, there's somehow you can, any field theory you can somehow decompose into a direct sum of so-called simple ones. And then if you want to figure out what type of, like how, yeah, just there's some way of decomposing field theory similar how you would decompose modules over an algebra. So, so there's something of that which we might do. Okay, questions? So, what we, the next thing we will do is now section three, which is classification. In 2D. So we went through this effort of figuring out what one-dimensional TQFTs are. They are just finite dimensional vector spaces, so this might be a bit boring, but along the way we learned a lot about TQFTs of any dimension. And now we will somehow do the same story, but in dimension two. And the classification will turn out to be via commutative Frobenius algebras that we will introduce probably next week. And then afterwards, we will actually look at the first slightly physical example, which are so-called Dyker-Witten series, which work in any dimension. Let me start with an observation. Okay, so just, I mean, so our classification of 1D theory somehow depends on an understanding of what are all possible compact one-dimensional manifolds. And the same will be true here as well. We understand two-dimensional manifolds also well enough to give a classification result. So the first thing is just related to the object, which says we already have seen this. Every closed oriented 1D manifold is diffeomorphic. To a disjoint union of let's just say standard circuits. So I want, and for all six, one preferred circle, which I call S1, which are just the points in R2, which have norm. And then any other one-dimensional manifold is diffeomorphic to a disjoint union of those. Okay. And so one thing which might be slightly confusing here is oriented. So you might think there are two oriented circles, right? The circle has two different orientations. However, if I have one circle, let's say it's oriented like this, then I just have another copy of it oriented like that. Then if I reflect along this axis, so if I just look at the reflection, this in a way that it maps this circle to this one, this is actually an orientation preserving diffeomorphism between the two different orientations on a circle. So the both orientations on a circle, they're actually related by an orientation preserving diffeomorphism. So up to diffeomorphism, there's only one orientation on a circle. So this implies S1 has one orientation, one orientation up to orientation in diffeomorphisms. Right, and in 1D, this was not true. The point has two orientations, a positive one and a negative one. However, there's no diffeomorphism relating them. I mean, the only diffeomorphism is the identity, and this will preserve the orientation. So here we see that whatever the field theory will assign to a circle actually becomes self-dual, because the dual is given by reversing the orientation, but then it's the same as the original object.
So why don't we allow the lines?
What lines? Ah, because it's closed. Closed means no boundary.
Oh, okay.
Means compact and no boundary. I mean, okay, I should probably say what we want to do. I mean, we want to understand this category, right? And its objects are closed one-dimensional manifolds. So we first want to understand all its objects. And we know that up to diffeomorphism, they are just disjoint union of circuits.
Sorry, why reflection preserves orientation?
I mean, it doesn't preserve, right? I mean, a reflection doesn't preserve orientation. So it means it maps one orientation to the other one. So it's a diffeomorphism between two different orientations. Right? So if I give you Rn and I do a reflection, this is an orientation-preserving diffeomorphism from Rn with its standard orientation to Rn with its reversed orientation.
And by orientation-preserving, you just mean, well, you induce a map between the orientations.
I mean, what I mean, right, an orientation is something like at a point, it tells me if I have like a basis or a frame, so I have n vectors, right? And then I have my diffeomorphism, and I can push them forward. And then if this is positive in the basis, it's also positive for the orientation for the new one. Right? Somehow you, right? So what I'm saying is I take this vector, and I apply the reflection, and then it will be mapped to this vector. No. Okay. Why am I? I take this
one. The one that changes in the one, the vertical one, is the, sorry, the one that on the point, the highest point of the circle, that one will change.
Yeah. So I have this, and then it will be mapped to this one. And this is exactly what it should do. So it's orientation preserving.
And is that true? I never thought about it, but is that true for all oriented manifolds?
No.
So
there are manifolds which are not diffeomorphic to their orientation. It's true in dimension 2.
Even in dimension 3, would it be false?
I think in dimension 3 it's false, yes.
No.
I can bring an example next time. Or you can Google, I think you. There are examples out there. I completely lost track of what to erase. I will just erase this. Yeah, I mean, yeah, so it's actually something interesting to say about that question. Yes. Right, if you know what a Bordism group is, they are somehow, you take all manifolds and you identify two of them as reciprocal Bordism between them. And this becomes a group under just taking disjoint union, where the inverse is exactly the orientation reversal. So if every manifold is diffeomorphic to its orientation reversal, this implies that the oriented Bordism group is trivial, but we know it's non-trivial. And for example, CP2 is a generator of omega 4. So we know CP2 has two different orientations. Like CP2 will not be isomorphic to its, or diffeomorphic to its orientation reversal.
I see. That doesn't mean the Bordism group must be true, I think, but it just means every element should be ordered true.
Yes, you're right. Good point, does it?
Sorry, I didn't hear the point.
His point is that my argument was wrong. It just implies that every object is ordered true, yeah. Because every object is isomorphic to its inverse.
Omega 4 is Z, so.
Yeah, okay, MYR. So CP2 is still, yeah. No, you're right. It's, it says that, yeah. If it's isomorphic to its inverse, So every object is order 2, but then if you have a Bordism group which is not 2 torsion, then you have know that things that cannot be diffeomorphic to the inverse. What was I doing? Exactly. So we know all the objects look like disjoint unions of circuits. So we just restrict to a smaller category. So we just define this thing and call board 2 prime, which is this full subcategory, meaning the morphism spaces stay the same of board 2. But it only has, so it's a full subcategory. So we with object, so I just restrict the object. In here I have a lot of different closed one-dimensional manifolds, and I just restrict to the objects with objects. And I call the objects bracket n, and I just define this as taking an n-fold disjoint union of the standard circle I fixed. So all the objects are either, and n is a natural number, which might also be 0. So I just take the empty set if n is 0, and then n is n copies of the standard circle. Okay. And by the observation over there, this functor is essentially surjective, and we take the full, on the morphism spaces, we do nothing. So it's also fully faithful. So this is actually an equivalence. And then this implies that if I look at functors out of the Bordism category, the two-dimensional Bordism category, to vect, I can restrict them along iota. So I get a map here, just restriction along iota to be functors out of this smaller thing. And this is an equivalence, just because this map is an equivalence. So we can restrict the objects to just look like this. So I mean, it's just a slight simplification.
If I say that this functor from board 2 prime to board 2 is essentially surjective, does that imply that not only are these all closed-oriented unity manifolds that diffeomorphic but also bordered?
Yes, diffeomorphic always implies bordered. Right, if I have a diffeomorphism, I think this is what I, from some sigma to some sigma prime, this allows me to always define a cobordism from sigma to sigma prime, which is essentially, which is this mapping cylinder. So I take sigma times 0, 1, but then I, or sigma prime, and then I use, right, I need to give some identifications here, and I use phi and the identity here. This thing is sometimes called a mapping cylinder. So from every diffeomorphism, you can build an invertible bordism between the objects. So you get this type of thing from a diffeomorphism. You might ask if any invertible bordism, so any isomorphism in the bordism category, comes from a diffeomorphism. This is true in low dimensions. In high dimension, it's not true anymore. Dimension 5 or higher, I think. And these things are called H cobordisms because they are invertible, but they are not coming from diffeomorphisms. Some dimension. The classification in 1D was based on understanding of one-dimensional manifolds, and this also enters here by understanding the object. But in 2D, we also need to understand two-dimensional manifolds, and this is the I think this might actually need a number because we will use it later. So this is 3.2, which says that if I have two compact oriented surfaces or 2D manifolds, so it's a sigma and sigma prime, then they are diffeomorphic. Meaning they exist in orientation preserving diffeomorphism if and only if if they have. Ah, I want to say connected. So also already in 1D we restricted ourselves to connected manifolds, and then all the other things are just disjoint unions also. So they are compact connected oriented manifolds. So if they have the same number of boundary components, right, just because sigma is connected, its boundary doesn't need to be connected, but we call n, and then also, and they also need to have the same genus, and the same genus, g. Let me just tell you what g is. G is defined as the following number. It's like 2 plus... Oh, I think I want to say there are k boundary components. So it's 2 plus k minus the Euler characteristic of sigma divided by 2. And now let me also tell you what the Euler characteristic of a surface is. Let me just tell you what the Euler characteristic of any space is. Of any manifold, and then maybe draw some pictures. Okay. The Euler characteristic of sigma, just defined as an alternating sum from 0 to infinity, but this will always be finite. Okay, I mean here to 2. And then I take the dimension of the homology of sigma, of the isohomology of sigma. So this is the Euler characteristic. Let me maybe just draw some examples. So g equals 1, k equals 0. This is a closed torus. It has one hole and no boundary components. K equals 2, let's maybe do K equals 3, G equals 0. This is 3 boundary components and no holes. So this is K equals 3. So there's a boundary here, here, and here. And there are no genus and so on. And anything which will be diffeomorphic to something looking like this. I think the last thing for today I will do is so in 1D we used that every one-dimensional manifold we can build out of these type of things, identities and splits. And we will use the same thing in 2 dimensions. So. Just start. So it's like every morphism in 2 prime can be built from the following morphisms. So we have this one, which just goes from empty to 1. Then we have this one, which is a borderism from 1 circle to 2. Then we have the things read the other direction. This is from 1 to empty. We have this thing, which goes from 2 circles to 1 circle. We again need the flip. So this is just the braiding. And then we also need identities. And any morphism in this morphism category we can build by taking tensor products, by composition. And tensor products. So the tensor product here just means disjoint. Okay. And how do we show that? I mean, first we should note that it's enough to show this for connected borderisms, because then all the other ones I can just get by taking disjoint unions. So I just need to show it for connected borderisms, but then over here we have learned how all of them look. So I just need to say, like, give you a borderism which has like an arbitrary number of incoming, an arbitrary number of outgoing boundaries, and some holes. And I just do this by giving you a standard form. So if I have something which has genus G and K boundaries, or just something which has genus G and goes from N boundaries to M boundaries, then I just write this thing as a composition of these two things, by these things, by doing the following. Oh. Okay, there's not enough space. But the idea is to give a normal form, or write these things as something we can build out of the generators. Right, I want to give you a borderism form. So I want to give you something which has n incoming discs, m outcoming discs. So here they are. N many. And here I have m many. M discs here. And I want to give you a borderism between these two things, which has genus G. So what I do is first, I start with all the discs here, and I use these generators. So and then I do nothing here, and there's something happening. So I just use this pair of pens or this generator to take these n discs and give a borderism to one disc. Then I want to have the resulting thing to have genus G. So I just insert these borderisms. So they are built out of this thing, but the other way around, and this thing, which is a composition of generators. I take G many of those. So and then I end up with a circle. So this just gives me the right genus, and then I want to go back, and I just do this by doing a bunch of co-products. So this thing will go here, and then I just continue doing these co-pair of pairs. And now I have built by just using these two things. Build for you a surface with n incomings and m outgoing things by just composing these two borderisms. But then the question is, what do I do if n is zero? And if n is zero, so for n equals zero, I just put this on the right. And for m equals to zero, I put this thing on the left for m equals zero, I put this thing on the right. So then if I want to, for example, build something from zero to zero of some genus, I just start here and compose these generators. And then I have G many and the other side. Okay. So we just have seen that we can bid all this. Oh, question, yeah.
It seems like you haven't used any swaps.
Yes. But this is only because I only considered connected things. But for example, here, also, but I didn't tell you how these things are ordered. I might do something like this, 2, 1, 3, and then all the other go somewhere. And I need the swaps to do these type of things.
Okay.
Here. So, I mean, somehow, I could have ignored the swaps because they are, right? I mean, these two things, they're really part of the categorical structure. This is the identity, and this is the braiding. And really, they are there for the right, and they behave like they would behave in any symmetric monoidal category. So it would be better to say it's generated under these four things as a symmetric monoidal category, including swaps. But yeah. And I mean, yeah, I should say this, this proof somehow is a shortened version of the proof in Joachim Koch's book, where he also more carefully argues that the swaps, what you need the swaps for, and especially if you have disconnected things, there might be some more swaps, and you can have relabeling of the inputs, so you will do some. There are more details on that in his book. Are there any further questions? Okay. I think I will stop here for today, and then next week we will just finish the classification of 2D and probably start a bit about the Dyckerf-Witten series. Okay, so yeah, thank you for listening.
Yeah. So maybe to recap, so the first part is more about the properties of the dual and therefore the category of 1D topological giftees, or rather, leverage these properties to find the fact that for any giftee, the vector space is finite dimensional because it's dualizable.
Yeah, and also if you have a finite dimensional vector space, it uniquely gives you a 1D TQFT.
Say that again, sir?
If you have a finite dimensional vector space, it uniquely gives you a 1D TQFT.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. And then there was stacking, which allows also to define invertible series, which I had heard a lot, plenty of times and never know what it means. I mean, I begin to know. And sorry, the last thing is, okay, classifying 2D things so that...
And we are halfway through, right? I mean, somehow, we already know now that to specify a field theory, I need only to specify its values on these four things, but then they need to satisfy some relations. And next week we will figure out what these relations are.
Okay.
I have a question. In condensed matter, people show that there is no pure topological order, I mean, without any global symmetry in 1 plus 1D.
Yes.
And we know that there is a bunch of 2D TFTs.
Yes.
What can we say about them?
What they show is... right, first of all, let me think for a second. The one thing you can say is any two-dimensional TQFT, let's say semi-simple, this is like what people in condensed matter will always assume implicitly at least, you can, this always decomposes as a direct sum of some invertible series. And then if you look at topological orders, you usually look at the modulo invertible things. So the only thing you can see are direct sums of invertible series if you don't have symmetries. If you have symmetries, they are small.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So is invertible theories directly correspond to symmetry-protected topological theories?
I mean, that's believed, yes.
Sorry.
It's believed that an invertible theory is the same as like a SPT, yes. I mean, you might give it as a definition, but there are different things people might call an SPT. And, but I think, like one way of saying what it is that the low energy effective TQFT, if it's defined, is invertible when you couple it to background fields.
Without any symmetry, the two-dimensional invertible series should be there. There's no such series.
You always have the Euler theory, if you restrict to reflection positive ones, there's none. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, I don't know. We might learn what this means, but there's this thing called SKK2, which classifies 2D invertible things. And then there's a thing called omega-2, which classifies reflection positive. So this is Z. And the field theories are classified by the Euler characteristic.
Mm-hmm.
And this is zero. Yeah. So there are no reflection positive ones, but there are a lot of other ones. Yeah. What I mean. Yeah, we should also see that as an example next week. Like a field theory, which is just something to the Euler characteristic.
And also, there were two times when where you invoked dimensional reduction, and one was to prove the normalizability, or the fact that vector space is always finite dimensional.
Yes.
And the first time, I had some concern about whenever you reduce, are you not losing information of the original thing in some sense? And
I mean, the reduction is a lot less information than the original thing, right?
Somehow it was constraining enough.
But I mean, right, somehow the reduction just tells you a small amount of information about the original theory. But somehow told us the information we wanted to know, namely that certain maps are invertible. Right. I mean, it's not true if you know the reduction, you cannot reconstruct the theory. You need to give more data.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, but the reduction always tells you something. I mean, this is also a common thing you do in more physical theories. You somehow quite often have a theory you really don't understand, but you at least understand some of its reductions. Okay. But there are these weird things in 6D.
So I suppose, and that's what we're doing now, no? To develop, classifying this theory so that we can dimensionally reduce and gain information about higher dimensional ones.
Exactly. And then also if you have like a 4D theory, you can build out 2D theories from it. You know there are Frobenius algebras, which will tell you something about the 4D theory. There's somehow information you can extract from higher dimensional series, which is easier to understand.